Okay. Now we're going to go into action and more action. Okay, I think one of the greatest things that the book has to say, I mean, there's so many fabulous things, but I love this. Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intense work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carrying this message to other alcoholics, you can help when no one else can. And I love that because that just goes to show that we can probably do more good for an alcoholic than anyone else. Sometimes they're like intimidated by their minister because if they're brought up like me, they're like, they feel like they're a sinner and they're going to burn in hell and all that stuff that goes with all that. Or if they're a psychologist, you know, what happens? I remember when before I knew that I was an alcoholic, I was going to doctors on the military base, and I mean, they were throwing all kind of medications at me because we look like we present in all kinds of different ways. And those things did not help me. If anything, it made it worse. And I'm not saying that there are, and I guess I just want to always keep clearing this up, is that I don't really have opinions about the medication thing because there are people who are ill and Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just don't want us to ever forget that. But when we're talking about a real alcoholic and that's all that's going on with them, we can help when others can't. And I can remember when I was working in treatment, and we were in a staff meeting, and this guy who I just loved him, and he was like running the treatment center, and he says, I want you to know how smart alcoholics are. And he says, if you are a non-alcoholic talking to the people that were working there, don't ever lean over and say to an alcoholic, I understand how you feel if you're not alcoholic. And you know, I have taken that with me in all areas of my sponsorship. And one of the things that a lot of the women I have things happen to them, and I don't think there's anything more insulting than me to say, I understand how you feel if it's not my experience. And I really try, and I feel blessed that I sponsor enough people that it seems like I can pretty much triage them to someone who has had that experience. But what happens is, you know, I try to say, I understand that had to be really hard for you. But I just don't try to put myself into being something I'm not. And because what happens is I think I lose the trust and confidence of the person. And that's what happens with a new alcoholic. That's why when we sit and talk about our story and we share our experience, that other alcoholic understands that. You can secure their confidence when others fail. And that's what we're trying to do, is secure their confidence. Because what happens, I don't know about you, but I sang this song for the longest until I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody understands me. That was my mantra. Nobody understands me. And what happened was I came into AA, and nobody was telling me what I should do. They were sharing their experience, strength, and hope with me. Remember, they are very ill. And so I tell you, sometimes I have to come back and read that paragraph because I can get really irritated with people I sponsor. And I mean, they don't have to just be newcomers. They can be people that have been around a while. I can get so irritated. And sometimes I just have to sit back and say a prayer. And then I have to just say something. I just have to say, you know something, honey? You're just going to have to do that for as long as you have to do it, and I just hope you don't get drunk over it. I mean, sometimes I just have to do that kind of surrender, because it just seems like I don't want to hear about it anymore. It's like the same old thing, you know, just keep going back over the same old thing. So I just have to remember they're very ill. And I love it. What Bob really helped me a lot, when a person is in an obsession like that, they can't do any better. They just can't do any better. And I have to remember that, because I can get very impatient with that. And I have to remember that they're very ill. And he just drove that home for me again this weekend, because I got a situation going on right now that I know, and I know this woman is in so much pain, and she's going through a divorce, and she just, I mean, it's hours on the phone, and pretty soon I just can't take it anymore. But I know she just, it's just all she can do. I mean, she's going to have to talk about it till she can't talk about it any longer. And I have to remember that I sponsor a woman who's lost some children in AA. And it's bad enough when you lose children, however you lose, but she has lost children sober. And that is, it's a devastating, because it's just out of the order of life. And I never tired of listening to her talk about her pain and her grief. But I find out this woman's in grief too. And it's not my business to judge whose grief is the worst. And I need to be patient with that. But boy, I'll tell you, sometimes it's hard. It's hard. So it's just love and tolerance is our code. Because, you know, I could just leave the phone out like this, just keep praying so I can stand it, and come right back and do an aha, and she could go right back on going on, you know. But it's, you know, I need to remember that, because these people are very ill, and this is part of 12-step work, and it's not always going to be fabulous. You know, somebody's going to run into AA, and you're going to get them, and you're going to get to sponsor them, and they're going to do the steps they're going to go right through them, and everything is going to be fantastic. But it doesn't happen that way. That is usually not my experience. Most of the time, it's just kind of pulling them through it right at first. Okay, here's some promises. Life will take on a new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you. You have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. I love this promise. I love this promise, because my life has new meaning. I'm useful today. I am a person who's useful, and I felt like I was a worthless human being because of what I had done to my children, what I had done to my husband, what I had done to my parents, how I hurt them so badly. I just felt like my life was worthless. And because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, today I know usefulness. I love that line that Bill has in his story. Today I know usefulness. To watch people recover. I can tell you, I get so excited when I have the privilege to give somebody a coin. And I sponsor a lot of people that are out of town. And I'm just so excited as I'm going to get a coin and a card for them, because they're celebrating more anniversaries. Watch them recover. I have this one sponsee, and I'd like to use her story because it's just so fantastic. And when I started sponsoring her, she had already been in AA for a little while, but she had a ninth grade education, and she was a prostitute. And what happened was, is she got sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's much like June G's story. She went and she got a GED, and she went to school, and now she's an attorney. And I got to be privileged to step by step. And when she would call me on the phone, and she was just, I can't stand it. I'm too exhausted. I can't, how am I going to go to school? I can't keep going, and I have to do AA. And she had to go to school and work. And she would just, and you know, we just in the morning, she was a 5 o'clock a.m. call that I got once a week. And we would get on the phone in the morning and I'd just say, you know, let's just pray right now that you're going to have the energy and that God is going to give you everything you need today to fulfill the day ahead of you. And I look at her today, and not only that, what's fabulous about her is she's an attorney with a heart. She is an attorney with a heart. And she works with a lot of women who she does family law, and every time I see her, I just thank God I got the privilege to watch her recover. Just the privilege. And this is a grandbaby of mine, and we do as-bill sees it, and in my Monday night meeting, and this is a deal in as-bill sees it that's in that book, and I happened to speak that week, and I got to use these promises, and we took this gift. Dave and I, we're always got a car full of people going somewhere or a hotel room full of people. So we had taken a bunch of people to our little group in Bellingham was that when we first got there, you almost had to take their pulse to see if they were breathing. And it was just a little flat, and there's about 15 of us. And we, you know, and it's just like trying to get it jump started, but you know, you don't go in there because nobody wants to know how you do it in Southern California. They just really don't want to know how you do it there. So here we were, we're just going to try to jump start this. So we knew about this conference in Beartooth, where these people are just really into it, and they're enthusiastic, and they're just so on fire. I mean, you talk about fire in the belly. They're on fire with Alcoholics Anonymous. So we filled the car full of people, and we went to Beartooth. And a couple of the gals, two of them were grandbabies, and two were sponsees of mine. So off we go to Beartooth. And they were so lit up. I love your term, lit up. They were so lit up by Beartooth that we got back to Bellingham, and they started getting, you know, started going. Now you ought to hear us. Everybody going up to the podium, there's clapping and there's yelling, and everybody's enthusiastic. And our meeting now is about 130 people. Because what happens is that enthusiasm, and it's very structured, and that enthusiasm and that structure is attractive. And I'm sure that's what I'm so excited about the meeting Monday night that I get to go to that Bill invited me to speak at, because I am so excited to see your meeting, because I love that. Clancy talks about pockets of enthusiasm. And when I got to go to Bob's meeting in Las Vegas, and it was all full of enthusiasm, this is the excitement. And I come out of that. I come out of that kind of enthusiasm. I mean, I went to a morning meeting in Long Beach that Frank Honeycutt started. A morning meeting at 7 o'clock with over 200 people every morning. People were getting up, and they were in there. And I'm telling you, that structure of that meeting was so down pat that part of the meeting was to go around and give your name. And, you know, I'm Polly, I'm an alcoholic, and on down the line. And we'd go through all 200 people introducing themselves, and then we'd get to the topic, whatever, out of some literature. And I mean, and it was an hour meeting. And I mean, it rolled. Frank was, he liked Arkansas meetings. He liked hour meetings. I live in Bellingham now, and they're hour meetings. I've gotten where I like them too. But anyway, it's to watch people recover, to see them help others. It's so fun. I had all weekend to be with Sylvia, and this is what's so exciting, is that she sponsors a big gaggle of women too. In fact, she has a big party at Christmas and all of this stuff, and it's amazing. You just love to watch the people you sponsor start to help others, to watch loneliness vanish. And to come in, and people have their head down, and they can't really get up, and they can't talk. And all of a sudden, you know, one of the things that I do to help people get out of the loneliness, especially if they're my sponsee and I feel like I have a little control over them, is I get them busy. If they're my sponsee, they have to have a job. that whatever it is, I don't care, but have a commitment. And, you know, I want people that I sponsor in a lot of meetings, and you have to have a commitment in every meeting. I was brought up like that, and I was so glad I got sober in Texas. I moved to Southern California, and they were thinking the same way I was thinking, because that's, you know, how are you going to start to feel a part of if you don't have a job? And the easiest way to start loneliness to go away is get in the kitchen and start, you know, cleaning up or making coffee or something, and people start coming around and talking to you. And it's an easy way to start to break the ice. And if you're shy, it's especially easy, because if you have a job, it feels like you're doing something. And if you have trouble starting out and can't make small talk and stuff like that, because the fellowship is fun, but a lot of us are uncomfortable when we start that. And it's wonderful to watch people all of a sudden go to coffee. And one of the things I love about Bellingham is, because the meeting's an hour, we always go to coffee. So that's a fun thing. So we always have the meeting after the meeting. So that's a lot of fun. To watch a fellowship grow up about you. And I really got to experience that in Bellingham, because everywhere I've been, I've been the one who walked into the fellowship, and the fellowship was there for me. And when we moved to Bellingham, and we were in this little meeting that was about 12 people, and I was just thirsting for that enthusiasm and that of what I was used to. And now I've just watched it grow up, about us. It's just absolutely the most exciting thing. And we sit in there, and I'm the setup person, because nobody would volunteer. I'm the oldest woman in the group, and I'm set up. But what's really fun is that I got a bunch of newcomers helping me. So, you know, God knows what he's doing. I was complaining about that. Nobody would volunteer to be set up. Well, I wasn't going to just let the job pass. And so I took it. But now what's happened is I've got about 6 or 8 newcomers that I'm having the best time with, and they're sponsored by women I sponsor. And so what happened was I needed help, so the women I sponsor told these girls that they have to help me. And then Dave sponsors a guy that sponsors a lot of young guys, and they're helping too. So now we're having a great time, because Dave and I ride to the meeting together. So now guess what? If I'm set up, so is he. So now we're both set up. We got all these kids working with us, and it's fabulous. And I started, see, there are no negatives in God's world. It's just my perception that's negative, that I think that something's going on. To have a host of friends. You know, sometimes I have so many friends, I can't keep up with the relationships. Talk about a host of friends. I can't give my friends enough time. I can't make communication and stay in touch with them. There's just not enough hours in the day for all the other phone calls I have. A host of friends. And I had no idea how many friends I had made. And it was almost 30 years. I think it was, 28 or 29 years sober when we did Toronto. And I couldn't believe how many people I knew all over the world. How many people I knew. Come on, a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. I just hope that whatever you do is to go into, you know, enjoy the 12 step. Be willing to pick up the phone. If somebody's new in your group and we have them stand up and identify as a newcomer, go up to them. Ask them if they have a sponsor. Now, I used to, you know, we'd all be running for the newcomer. And now what I do is I try to get the women I sponsor so they have lots of people to sponsor. But I don't know where we, you know, ever got the idea that newcomers have to come to us. I mean, I don't know who ever started. I mean, that's not the way AA started. I mean, that's, you came into a meeting and a sponsor was handed to you, and that person took you to meetings. And so I still believe that way. And we see somebody stand up in a meeting, and you should see us. We're all running to her, you know, like white on rice, you know, and saying, you've got a sponsor, you know. Everybody's trying to get the newcomer. But get the people who are new, and then get them. We get out the meeting book and said, I'm going to be at this meeting. You're going to pick her up here. We're going to pick you up here. And I mean, there's just like all of a sudden, they're there, and we give them our number, but be sure to get their number. Don't ever forget to get their number, because what happens is people who walk into Alcoholics Anonymous are scared. And when you're saying, give me a call, they're scared to do that. But if I call them two or three times, then they'll call me back, for the most part. Sometimes they don't, but a lot of times they will. But I hope I never get too sober to call a newcomer. I hope that never happens to me. Sponsoring, it's wonderful. It's a fabulous way to do 12-step. But I also do, our group sponsors detox. We have one of these treatment centers for girls under 18 called Visions in Bellingham. And we take meetings to Visions. We have a treatment center that we take meetings to. We have jail meetings. And all of us try to be, you know, we have sign-up sheets, and different groups go there every week. And Dave and I always try, and the girls I sponsor, to be on those sign-up sheets. Go to the jails. Be a part of. If your group is supporting a meeting and going there, be a part of. I know one of the things I did in early sobriety when I was in Texas was H&I. That was hospitals and institutions. And I used to take a meeting, which sounds like a lot of people. I know Pete does it and Bob does it. I took a meeting once a week into this facility. It was a federal prison, and I would take it in there to these women. And then a lot of times since it was a minimum security prison, you can take them out and you can bring them to a meeting and such things as that. And I always was involved in that, and today I'm involved in a jail meeting in Bellingham. Get involved in 12-step work. Be willing to go make a 12-step call. Listen, I tell you, even though I worked in treatment for 15 years, I love it that we're going back to more 12-step calls. And I think that it's fabulous. And, you know, just be willing for somebody to throw up on your shoes. It's okay. You know, and throw up in your car. And just go do that, because it's just one of those things you just don't want to miss. And I'm just so grateful that I've been willing to pick up the telephone. Pick up the telephone. Answer the phone. And just be, it's the thing that just, it's what lights me up. It puts the fire in my belly, is to do 12-step work. I love having the opportunities that I get to have to come do what I'm doing this weekend. I've met so many people, and it's been so much fun. And I just be a part of it. It's just something you just should not miss. And one of the things that, let me just go through some of the book here. The other thing is that it's be careful in that some people just don't want what we have. And sometimes it's like, I don't really know, I've had to learn when to just let go. And sometimes we have to just let a person go because they're taking up so much time, and they're not, I think I was talking to a lady earlier, when somebody starts occupying all your time, just kind of sit back and evaluate that, because I thought about this more after I got through talking to her. Just sit back and evaluate that a little bit. If they're taking up all of your time, maybe you might need to say, am I spending so much time on this person and I could be working on someone else who really wants it? So sometimes we have to discern that. But and the other thing is I also try to involve the family when I'm working a 12-step with someone, or when I'm trying to sponsor someone, I try to involve the family as well, so that all of this can work together, and that at least offer them. And I feel like I'm pretty blessed because I'm in both programs. I'm in Al-Anon and I am in AA, and I think it's really important you know, because I know, I mean, I'm in a lot of Al-Anon meetings, and I know how upset the Al-Anon is that the AA walks into Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, they get sober, and here, that's the other person over here is the one that's been through all the, you know, all the crap. And it's like, hey, you know, I know how you must be feeling. Look, there's something available to you. And offer them Al-Anon. Show, point them in that way, too. Even if you're not, you know, if you don't even know anything about Al-Anon, just say, you know, there's something for you as well. So, okay, Bob.
Thanks, Polly. I'm Bob Darrow, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bob.
Polly sponsors a lot of women. Alcoholics Anonymous saves our lives. In exchange for that, we're given a purpose that's greater than ourselves, which is unusual for a guy like me when my purpose all my life has been me and my feelings and my security and my. And everything I believe that we've done up to this point is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. This chapter 7, in essence, is a sponsorship manual. And I, you know, I made a lot of mistakes in sobriety. In my early sobriety, I was pushed into doing 12-step work by the old-timers in AA, and I mean, what do I have to bring to the table except no self-esteem and a big ego? I mean, that's what I got, really. I mean, and so I bring that to the table with 12-step work. On the top of page 90, this chapter tells you what to do and what not to do. And I don't know what's more important, what to do or what not to do. And I didn't follow this chapter because I never read it. Because smart guys don't need directions, right? It says when you discover a prospect for Alcoholics Anonymous, find out all you can about him. If he does not want to stop drinking, don't waste time trying to persuade him. You may spoil a later opportunity. And I would get these 12-step calls and it's all about me. This guy's going to stay sober because if he doesn't, I'm going to look bad, right? So I'd be hammering him the evils of drinking and I just got to kill you, you know, and I just work this, do AA or die, you know. It was just horrible. And I don't know that any of those guys got sober. There's an old Persian proverb about doing that, and it says it's like trying to teach a pig to sing. Not only doesn't it work, it annoys the pig. And I annoyed a lot of pigs. And the sad part about that is that, you know, there are people who call Alcoholics Anonymous for help that aren't really ready yet, but they might be in another 6 months or a year, right? And I did that. Before I ever came to AA, I used to, you know, I get these calls all the time. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. You're just about out of vodka. You've called all your old girlfriends who weren't really that happy to hear from you. So you call Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't really want to get sober. You're just lonely and need to talk to somebody, you know? So I'd get these guys that would call kind of for that. I'd put on my Mighty Mouse cape and here I come. To say, you know, and I'd go out and get these guys and I'd put them in my car and I'd preach to them. And oh, man. If I'd have followed this, maybe I'd have been a good example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And consequently, maybe 6 months or a year later when they hit a real bottom, they would have come to us. But I'm afraid that I was probably such a self-righteous, preachy, bad example of AA that some of those people may never come to AA now as a result of me. And I didn't do that out of malice. I did it out of ignorance. You know, I really thought I was helping. You know, my favorite line is the last sentence in the second paragraph. It's talking about listening, get an idea of the guy's behavior, etc. And says, you need this information to put yourself in his place to see how you would like him to approach you if the tables were turned. This is really an exercise in other-centeredness, working with newcomers. And I was listening to Polly talk about some of her sponsees, and I think there's an unconscious sponsor prayer that's very similar to the unconscious parent prayer. And as we, I hope you get a sponsee just like you one day. The parents say that about their kids. I hope you have kids just like you.
That's right.
One of the reasons that the book is so adamant about pushing newer guys into helping others is that it's an amazing thing. If you've ever sponsored anyone that refuses to sponsor other people or do 12-step work, you have an ongoing high-maintenance situation. They just – it's almost to the point where when the phone rings, you go, oh, God, I hope it's not that. And they just start. And once you get them sponsoring other people, it's like it's amazing thing happens. They become low maintenance because – and then the phone calls shift. Now they call – and I have most of the guys I sponsor now are calling me about the people they sponsor.
Right, right.
And it's wonderful. It's a great, great thing. Page 91, third line down in the third paragraph, it says, tell him enough about your drinking habits, symptoms, and experiences to encourage him, to speak of himself. One of the kindest, most loving and amazing things that happened to me when I was brand new is I'd go out to coffee with people and they'd listen to me. Nobody had listened to me for years. I was almost invisible. There's such alcoholism is such a lonely business. And I knew these people were listening to me because they would interject little bits and pieces of their own experience that let me know that they knew exactly what I was talking about. I remember I have a scene. I hope I never – it's etched in my brain. I hope I never forget it. I was in this park. And I remember the loneliness of alcoholism, how I don't even have anybody to talk to. And I got this bottle of wine in a brown paper bag, and I'm like wild hair that's long and just crazy. I think I must have looked like Aqualung from, you know, that character from Jethro Tull. And I am just half drunk and half full of self-pity. And I'm in the park. And there's a bunch of pigeons there. And I am ranting and raving to the pigeons about what my parents did to me and about injustices of society. And out of the corner, I hope I never forget this, out of this corner of my eye, I see this man and woman going through the park. And they're coming down the path over here and they see me and just bolt across the grass to another to get away from me. And it was like a glimpse in my – I thought, oh, I'm that guy. Oh, I'm the guy. I'm the crazy ranting, raving guy in the park. I'm that guy. And as a result of that experience, I've seen some homeless guys on the streets. And you see them talking to themselves. Imagine the loneliness that they feel. Alcoholics get thrown away all the time. In Alcoholics Anonymous, people listen to me. I think it's the most loving thing we do for each other. They gave me something that they could never get back. They only had it once, and that was their moments, their time. Very, 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 very powerful. Page 92. This is very interesting. And when I started doing this, I started feeling like I was being a little more effective with brand new guys. And this is not done much anymore. And I think this is when Alcoholics Anonymous was the most effective. I think a lot of the dilution of the message, I think a lot of the reduction of our success rate across the fellowship. Now, I think the success rate of people who really try the program, buy the whole package, is as high, if not higher, than it's ever been. But that has become, the people that actually do that have become probably a minority in the fellowship, unfortunately. If not a minority, at least it's there's a significant amount of people that aren't. And in the old days, what they would do is this page 89 through page 92 describes an interviewing process. And this is before the guy ever gets to go to a meeting, before he gets to see the book, before anything. You interview this guy. And then it says at this point, if you are satisfied that he is a real alcoholic. In other words, he's got to kind of pass the test. And how often, and I'm guilty of this, how often in my desire to be helpful and other-centered and help God's kids have I not done this? And consequently, I had a guy I sponsored that wasn't an alcoholic who stayed sober and sponsored people and then went back to drinking successfully. All his sponsors, none of his sponsors made it through that because they got to watch their sponsor drink and make it look good because he was an alcoholic. But my ego liked him. Because he told me I was a great speaker. Told me he really identified with him. He just got brighter, right, as he was saying that. He just got more intelligent right before my eyes. So you interview the guy, and if you're satisfied he's a real alcoholic, begin to dwell on the hopeless feature of the malady. Show him from your experience how the queer mental condition surrounding that first drink prevents normal functioning of the will. And then it talks about some other things. And in the next paragraph, it says, continue to speak of alcoholism as an illness, a fatal malady. Three lines down from that, it says, explain many are doomed who never realize their predicament. And it goes a couple lines below that. It says, talk to him of the hopelessness of alcoholism. You know, it's really hammering this point across. And you don't see that anymore much. You don't see it much anymore in 12-step work in AA. This wanting to fix people. I've watched in meetings over the years on many occasions, some new guy will be in the meeting and he'll tell everybody, I just relapsed and I just don't feel like I have what it takes to stay sober. I can't do it. I don't feel like I can do it. And I don't know. I just keep drinking again. And there'll be a flurry of hands of people that can't wait to tell him how he's wrong. Can't wait to tell him, no, you could just stay. You can make up your mind, man. Just don't drink no matter what. You can do this. And the book's saying, no, don't do that. Tell him the truth. You feel like you don't have what it takes to not drink? Yeah, you don't. You're right. Absolutely. Yeah, you don't. You feel like you're dying? You're right again. You feel hopeless? Oh, you just hit it out of the ballpark, kid. I'm telling you. Tell them the truth. And we can tell, later on in the book, it says that we can do that. If we didn't have a solution, it'd be cruel to do that. But we can do that because we have a way out. We can do that because, and it's a matter of fact, not only can we do it, we must do it because unless the person gets that, why would they buy the rest of the package? I mean, nobody would unless you don't have an alternative. If you can beat this thing on your own, beat it. Good. The book says earlier, our hats are off to you. But if you're an alcoholic of our type, and that's what we're trying to diagnose here, we're trying to find out if the guy's a real alcoholic. Page 94, you start to outline, and this is after he's passed muster, you start to outline the program of action, explaining how you made a self-appraisal, how you straightened out the past, why you were endeavoring to be helpful to him. So you're kind of giving him a thumbnail sketch of the actions you have taken. And this part is really beautiful. It says it's important for him to realize, and I need to help him to realize, that my attempt to pass this on to him plays a vital part of my recovery. Bill Wilson sought out Dr. Bob, not because Dr. Bob was an alcoholic. That was incidental. Bill Wilson sought out Dr. Bob because Bill Wilson was an alcoholic. I do 12-step work because I have alcoholism, not because they do. So explain that to him. And then make it plain he is under no obligation to you, that you only hope he will try to help other alcoholics when he escapes his own difficulties, and suggest how important it is that he place the welfare of other people ahead of his own. It's so easy to get caught up in newcomers' problems, and they got problems. Oh man, I had problems in every area of my life. I had emotional problems, mental problems, police problems, employment problems, family problems. I had problems on every front. And it was odd that the people in Alcoholics Anonymous didn't really want to deal a whole lot with that. They kept pushing me to God and the steps and helping others. And the only time they even looked at any of my problems at all was to, and you almost don't want to tell them after they do this a couple times. You end up paying people money. I mean, when you tell them, they want me to make amends. They want me to do all that. If you're like me, it's kind of like, listen, yeah. But what about me? What about, can't you help me to fix this stuff? No. We're going to go over here and we're going to trust God, clean house, help others. Let's see what happens. And it's really, that's a big job, is not to get sucked into the problem, because then I become a part of the problem and I'm no longer a transmitter of the solution. I become a part of their problem. And you can get, if you do that, and I've done this, and I've done that, where I get so wrapped up in their problems that I become non-effective. It just drains my spirit out, because somewhere I seem to have an inability to get immersed in your problems without emotionally feeling similar about them than you do. And then I've walked away from the answer, and I'm part of your problem, part of the problem. Which is this, isn't that the same thing that your parents did? Your husband and wives did? And how did that work? Right, it didn't work. So we're carrying a message here. Page 95, it says, middle of the page, great paragraph, it says, if he's not interested in your solution and he expects you to act only as a banker for his financial difficulties or a nurse for his sprees, you may have to drop him until he changes his mind. This he may do after he gets hurt some more. It says a kind of a similar thing on the top of page 96. It says, do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. And you're looking, it's talking about the type of person you're looking for. Someone who's desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. We find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. And I wasted a lot of time like that. In this chapter, it also, page 98, in the middle of the page, it says something very interesting. It says, it's not the matter of giving that is in question, but when and how to give. That often makes the difference between failure and success. The minute we put our work on a service plane, in other words, I'm gonna be the welfare, I'm gonna be the core, I'm gonna be the legal advice, I'm gonna get him to turn, I'm gonna fix his problems. The minute I do that, the alcoholic commences to rely upon my assistance and my power to fix his problems, rather than upon God. He'll clamor, and he will. It's never enough. You know that problem you just fixed? Oh, there's 10 behind it. he'll clamor for this or that, claiming he cannot master alcohol until his material needs are cared for. Nonsense. Some of us have taken very hard knocks to learn this truth. Job or no job, wife or no wife, we simply do not stop drinking so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence on God. And the next couple, two lines are very powerful. It says, burn the idea into the consciousness of every man that he can get well regardless of anyone, anything. The only condition is the trust in God and clean house. I made a lot of mistakes in early sobriety. There was a I want to fix guys' problems. I don't know about this. So I try to, I get guys' jobs. You know, I meet a newcomer. He's out of work and he's whining about not having a job. And I'll know somebody else in AA that has a business or manages a business. So I'll go to the guy and play on my friendship with this guy to get him to hire the new guy. And then the new guy gets drunk and robs him, right? I mean, that happened. There was a guy who was sponsoring who, my ego was so involved in it. I really wanted this guy to stay sober because I'm going to look bad if he doesn't. And he doesn't want to do anything. I can't even get him to go to meetings unless I go and pick him up and take him to the meeting. There's something wrong with the picture. If I'm putting more energy into his recovery than he is, there's something wrong with that picture. But I don't know it. I don't know any better. And he just won't do anything. And he just, I got to. It's like pulling teeth. And he's all he wants to do is whine about these warrants that are out for his arrest in another state. And like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to stay sober worrying about those. He's just on and on and on and on. And there was a guy in Las Vegas who was a federal judge. He was a he was in AA, very powerful man. And I never imagined how powerful he was. Actually, after he died, they named the federal building in Las Vegas after him. He was a very powerful judge, and he was a good guy, and he liked me. He called me whippersnapper. Him and this other guy in the men's thing used to call me, "Is that Bob, that whippersnapper?" Isn't it? You know, they're old guys. I'm a young kind of guy, a little full of myself. And I went to Roger, and I lied to Roger. Here's what I said to him. I said, "Roger, I'm working with so-and-so, and he really wants to be sober. Now, what's true is I'm working with so-and-so and I really want him to be sober." And then I lied to Roger again. I said, "Roger, he's really doing AA." No, he wasn't. I'm trying to make, what was true is I'm trying to make him do AA. I really wanted him to do AA. And I start telling Roger about these warrants. And I said, "You know, I don't know if he's going to make it with those hanging over his head." Roger, I gave Roger his information and a couple things and his statistical stuff that he needed. And Roger says, "Let me see what I can do." And he made a couple phone calls and the warrants disappeared. He was drunk within a week after finding out he was no longer under those warrants. I think I look back, I think it would have been kinder to put a bullet in his head. Right? I robbed him of what had brought him to us. And maybe, and I don't know this, I can't foresee futures that don't exist, but maybe if he wouldn't have been out from under that fear and desperation might have drove him to actually start doing some of this stuff in AA. But I know one thing, when it was taken away from him, he had no reason to even, he just went back out again. There's an old Peruvian proverb that tells the story of a farmer who grows up infatuated by these luminescent blue butterflies. And I have a couple on my wall at home. They're really beautiful. They're opalesque. They change colors in the sunlight. And this farmer was obsessed with these butterflies. And he found, as an adult working on his property, he found one of their cocoons at the edge of his property. And he put a little chair down there, and every day after he'd done working, he'd get out and sit in that chair and just watch that cocoon, waiting with almost a joyous anticipation for this butterfly he's going to actually see come out of that cocoon. And he's just, it's excited. And after a while, he could see it starting to struggle to break out of the cocoon. And he was getting more and more excited. But he watched it struggle and struggle and struggle. And after a while, he became afraid that, oh my God, maybe this time the cocoon's too thick, or maybe the butterfly's not strong enough. And his self-centered fear drove him to take his knife and very gently make a tiny little slit on the side of that cocoon. And the butterfly wiggled out through that slit, but it fell to the ground and it laid there to die because its wings were pale and underformed because it hadn't struggled enough. How many of us go on years past the point of a bottom? Because people come and slit our cocoons. Not out of malice. One of the greatest things my parents ever did for me, and I thanked them until the days they died, I always would constantly bring it up, and I just thanked them. I'd say, you know, you saved my life by cutting me out of your life and refusing to help me anymore. And they did. They did. They saved my life. If in 1978, if my dad would have said, "Look, I'll call some friends of mine up. I'll get you another job. You can come back and stay at our house. And here's a couple hundred. Get back on your feet." I'm telling you, I'd had a different sobriety date, for sure. If I had one at all. So, trying not to cut people's cocoons. In the beginning of the chapter, Polly touched on this in the first page, page 89. It talks about nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works where other activities fail. And then the last line in this paragraph I've really cherished this line. It says, remember, they are very ill. I get people all the time call me up and they start going off about somebody in AA. And I'll say, I want you to read the last line of the first paragraph in chapter 7. Call me back. And they call me back. Oh, yeah, they're very ill. Yeah. Let's not forget where we are. This is Alcoholics Anonymous, the largest outpatient clinic in the world. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. We depended on the contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Most of us are doing okay. But any one of us who stops doing certain things in our life and takes the wheel again starts to get ill. I mean, it's just the nature of the beast. Polly and I are a lot alike, which I don't know if that's good news or bad news. I don't know. But I think it means we both need AA desperately. But I'm the depressive alcoholic also. I had been clinically depressed diagnosis at one time. A doctor had one time told me, and I was also another time diagnosed as a free-floating anxiety panic disorder. I'd been told that I would probably take medications all my life, and I haven't taken anything in over 29 and a half years. But I am like Bill Wilson. On page 15, Bill talks about something. If you go down about 10 lines, Bill says, I was not too well at the time. This is in his first year of sobriety. And actually for Bill, he picked it up again when he moved to Stepping Stones and got out of the trenches of being at the Calvary Mission and Towns Hospital every day. He said, I was not well at the time and was plagued by waves of self-pity, which is depression, and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink. But I soon found that when all other measures fail, work with another alcoholic would save the day. And this what he's saying in the next couple lines is exactly my experience. He says, many times I've gone to my old hospital in despair. On talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It is a design for living that works in rough going. I was pushed by old timers into 12-step work when I was brand new. I mean brand new. I hadn't been through the rest of the steps, and I don't know why I'm doing it. I thought, well, maybe AA is a membership problem or something. They're trying to send, like, it's like a pyramid thing. They're sending me, like, me out to, you know, do stuff. And I said, God, they must be desperate for members to send me out. And I told this guy, I said, you know, I know what you're saying about helping others, but I don't really feel ready just yet. After I feel ready, I will start helping others. And he said to me, he says, kid, if you wait until you feel ready before you do that, you'll already be dead from alcoholism. Just do it. And I started doing 12-step work. I was brand new. I did stuff in those days you can't even do today. I got qualified to go into the state penitentiary when I was not even 3 months sober. You can't even do that nowadays. You got to have a certain amount of sobriety, all kinds of stuff. They were just starting some of those programs. They didn't know anything. I started going back into the detox I was in every week. I started going to other places around town, and something happened, but I didn't really get it for a while. Is that after spending time with some of these new guys, I would feel better. But I don't connect the dots right away. I'm not getting what it's why I don't cause and effect it, kinda. And one night I was sober over a year, and I'd gone to two meetings that day. I prayed, I talked to my sponsor, and I'm sitting at my apartment. I'm sinking into a deep depression, and it's a horrible depression. And I had horrible depressions. I remember sitting on the sofa, and this used to sometimes happen to me, where I would get so depressed, it would physically affect me till it felt like I weighed 1,000 pounds. It was like everything would just droop and just like, you know, it's like horrible, and it's very painful. The self-pity is not bad with a fifth of vodka. There's a warm mushiness about it, you know, that you can start, you can almost, it's almost ego gratifying to think to yourself, I just suffer more than anyone else. You know, there's a smug superiority in that, right? But sober, it's a very, very painful thing. And I do not discount depression. It's very real and it's very painful. And I don't know what to do, and I can't take anything. They won't let me in AA. I was in that period before where the AA was fairly medication free. We just came out of the Valium debauchery, and we're in that brief window where people were doing pretty. They were forced to work the steps. I mean, it was forced to do service. And I don't know what to do, and there's a meeting at not too far from my apartment at 10:15, and it's about almost 10 o'clock, and I thought if I could get to that meeting, maybe I'd be okay. Maybe I'd hear something that would snap me out of it. And I said a prayer, and I somehow muscled myself off that sofa. It was hard. I was like I weighed 1,000 pounds, and I shuffled out to my car like a mope, and so if you're really going to feel sorry for yourself, you have to develop that burdened walk, you know. The problem with me as an alcoholic, I drink of my feelings like I drank alcohol. I mean, everybody gets blue. I don't just get blue. I get into it, man. I'm into it. And I go to this meeting, and I sit in the back of the room, and I can't hear nothing because I'm so self-obsessed. I loved what Polly said about depression. Depression is the most self-obsessed I could ever be, next to suicide. Suicide is, the ultimate self-obsession. Right below that is self-pity. And I'm really consumed with myself. And consequently, I can't hear anything because I'm just focused so much on my feelings and my thoughts and my problems and my deficiencies. And there's a guy in the back of the room coming off a drunk, and he's in bad, bad shape, and he can't sit still. He's grabbing himself, and he's rocking back and forth like he wants to jump out of his skin. And he gets up, and he's pacing in the meeting like a caged animal. And you can hear him time to time, the bathroom dry heaving. He's just, he's, I'm trying to figure some stuff out here. He's annoying the crap out of me is what he's doing, really. The meeting's over. I'm coming out of the meeting. Me and the secretary, last two people to leave the meeting, and the guy's laying on the ground in front of my car in a fetal position. And the guy that's the secretary can't help him because he's got to go to work. He works a graveyard shift at one of the casinos. It's like almost time for him to get there. And I'm looking at this guy, and Charlie's saying, "Aren't you help this guy?" I don't want to help him. I want to go home and think. It's what I really want to do. I want to go home and focus on more strongly on myself. But Charlie's nudging me, and now Charlie's got a big mouth. If I don't help this guy, he'll tell everybody. And I go over and I start talking to the guy. He's a mess. He's peed his pants. He has no medical insurance. He's afraid of convulsions. So I end up taking him to the county hospital because it was the only place to take him. There was no detox at the time. They hadn't opened West Care yet, and they'd closed Starting Point. It was that period in our AA history in Vegas where there was no place to take you if you didn't have medical insurance. And you had the care unit, but you had to have medical insurance or money. So I take him to the county hospital because I knew from past 12-step experiences that they eventually will take you in there. Because they get government money, they'll take a certain amount of indigent patients, but they don't treat you well. They get this attitude towards drunks. So I'm in this waiting room in the hospital waiting for them to give him a bed, and I'm talking to him. He's talking to me, really, and he's telling me about the shame and remorse that he feels he can't even drink away from the things he did to his family and the people that loved him. And he's telling me that for some time he'd been thinking about suicide and wished he had the courage to just kill himself. He doesn't want to go on like this anymore. And then he says to me, I'll never forget this, he said, I don't know why you're wasting time with me. I'm not like you people in AA. I always drink again. And man, he's talking about me. And in the wee hours of the morning, I fell in love with him. I don't know why he can't give me anything or do anything for me. Except that what I discovered later is I fell in love with the me that was in him. A part of me I could never, ever love directly. I had to first love it in you before I could accept it and love it in me. And I went home that night, or that actually early morning. It was the sun was starting to come up after they gave him a bed. And I'm crying as I'm driving home, and I'm not crying because I'm depressed anymore. I'm not depressed. I'm crying because I don't know if I've ever felt more complete, more right about myself in my life as I did at that moment. It was like everything made sense. I felt the presence of God in that car so strongly, and it wasn't as a result of prayer or meditation. Bill in his story says something, Polly had touched on this, and I want to reiterate it because it's so important. Bill has a vision of spiritual growth here. The bottom of 14, he says, for if an alcoholic failed to perfect in his large his spiritual life through two things, and it's not prayer and meditation, through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. You want to grow, you want to enlarge your spiritual life, you want to get closer to God, help his kids. Help his kids. I've never felt closer to God than at moments when I'm being useful because I am out of the way. I've had moments in listening to fifth steps. I've had moments on 12-step calls. I've had moments where I feel so plugged in. And it's not through prayer and meditation. And I'm not putting down prayer and meditation. It's essential. But it's really from 12-step work. It's an amazing... I'll tell you one little story and then I'll shut up. Then I'll read something and shut up. When I was in my 11th year of sobriety, and when we were doing the 4-step, you guys heard me talk about my divorce and how I'd found out that my sponsee, my favorite sponsee, had been sleeping with my wife the last year of my marriage. And now my daughter and ex-wife are now living with him and living together. And I love my daughter. I always have, always will. Since the divorce, I've seen her every week. At least I spend at least part of a day with her, if not more, every week. And this is right after the divorce, and I have to go pick her up a Sunday morning. We're going to spend the day together. And I have to drive up to where they're living together. And I'm out in the car, and I got a knot in the pit of my stomach. And I get out of the car, and I'm shaking inside, and I'm walking up because I still got this resentment. And I'm walking up to the door, and I knock on the door, and the door's answered by the happy couple. And they get my daughter, and she hugs them and comes with me, and I take her by the hand. She's only like 2 years old, I guess, maybe a little over two. And I have it all set up for us to do a bunch of stuff that day. And one of the things we were going to do is we were going to this ranch that some friends of mine were involved with. And it was a fun day for us. She got to play with the animals. They had all kinds of animals there. And she got to ride the ponies. She was excited about being – we could put her on these ponies and walk her around the corral. You know, it was really cool. And we're done with the ponies when there's a picnic bench, wooden picnic bench right next to the corral. And we're sitting on the picnic bench with the gal who works there, and me and McKate. And Kate wants something to drink. She's thirsty. So back at the stables, next to the stables, they have a soda machine. So I'm walking across the yard to get her a soda. And I get her a soda, and I get myself one, and the gal one. I'm coming back with these three sodas. And the girl who works there says to my daughter, "Hey, Kate, here comes your dad." And Kate looks up, looks at me, looks at the woman, says, "Oh, no, that's not my daddy. Craig's my daddy." And it felt like somebody had stuck a knife right in my heart and just twisted it. I didn't say nothing. I put a smile on my face because I love my daughter. And I know she don't know what she's saying. But on an emotional level, it just cut me. It's very, very painful. And we spent the rest of the day together, and I had to take her home that evening, and I would pull up in front of where they're living, and I walk her up to the door and ring the doorbell, and the happy couple answers the door. She jumps into his arms, and I turn around, I wave goodbye, turn around, walk away, and I get in my car, and I drive about a block away, and I pull over, and I just come apart at the seams. And I'm sitting in that car, and I'm sobbing, and I'm talking to God. And I'm saying to God, I can't do this. This hurts too much. I can't do this. I love my daughter, but this hurts too much. I'm not big enough for this. I look at the clock, and I got to meet this new guy. He's a knucklehead in front of the turning point on Main Street. This old AA club used to be there. And I'm kind of rush over, so I head out to meet this guy. I don't want to go meet him, but I told him, and you guys have hammered it into me. You do what you say you're going to do. You show up where you say you're going to show up, and I got to meet this guy. What I really want to do is go home, lick my wounds, and think. But I got to go meet this guy, and I get to the turning point. He's walking up on the sidewalk, walking back and forth on the sidewalk in front of the club. I'm taking him to another meeting across town. So I said, "Come on, get in the car." And he gets in the car, and he starts talking to me. And he's not even in the car a minute. He starts crying because he's telling me he'd been denied by the courts again to ever see his kids. And it was like a postcard from God. It said, "Dear Bob, you can see your daughter." I thought to myself, yeah, I'll do this one more week. One more week. And one more week. And one more week. And it's 18 years later, and I've never missed a week. My daughter and I take trips. He's come and gone, and I'm her dad, and I always will be. And God can't work in your life like that unless you're in those arenas. I couldn't have got that if I had went home after that and thought about it, I wouldn't have come to the same. I probably would have never seen my daughter again because I would have been indulging self. And God's saying, "Bob, he's pushing me. He's pushing me to do the right thing." I love my daughter. She's the light of my life. And I almost missed it. There's an old saying in AA, if you want to get goosed by the spirit, you got to get up off your butt. There was an old poem that was in the grapevine years ago. It said, I sought myself and could not see. I sought my God. He eluded me. I sought my brother and I found all three. I want to get closer to God, help his kids. I'm going to read something and then I'm going to quit. I have always hated people who read poems in AA meetings. It's tacky. It really is. It's tacky. I'm going to risk being one of those kind of guys because of this. This has meant so much to me over the years, and I think it's our story. It was written by Bill Wilson's spiritual advisor in New York in the early days, the guy who was kind of head of the Oxford group there. His name is Samuel Shoemaker. He's mentioned in AA literature a lot. You got to understand that not everybody in the Oxford group liked the alcoholics coming to their meetings. We were called the drunk squad. And matter of fact, Buckman and Wilson had a big falling out because Buckman wanted Bill Wilson to go testify to the rich and work with the rich to bring them into the Oxford group because he believed that spirituality should start with the wealthy, right? And it would swell their coffers. But Bill didn't want to do that. Bill just wanted to go down to the mission. He wanted to work with the guys like me. He went to Towns Hospital, and Sam watched him. And I suspect Sam wrote this as a result of watching what Bill and the early members of AA did, because it is what they did, and it is what we do to this day. It's called I Stand by the Door. I stand by the door. I neither go too far in nor stay too far out. The door is the most important door in the world. It is the door through which men walk when they find God. There's no use my going way inside and staying there when so many are still outside, and they, as much as I, crave to know where the door is. And all that so many ever find is only the wall where a door ought to be. They creep along the wall like blind men with outstretched, groping hands, feeling for a door, knowing there must be a door. So I stand by the door. The most tremendous thing in the world is for people to find that door to God. The most important thing any person could ever do is to take hold of one of those blind, groping hands and put it on the latch that clicks and opens only to that man's touch. People die outside the door as starving beggars die on cold nights in cruel cities in the dead of winter. They die for want of what is within their grasp. They live on the other side of it. They live there because they have not found it. Nothing else matters compared to helping them find it and open it and walk in and find him. So I stand by the door. Go in, great saints. Go all the way in. Go way down into the cavernous cellars and way up into the spacious attics. It is a vast, roomy house, this house where God is. Go into the deepest of hidden casements of withdrawal, of silence, of sainthood. I suppose some must inhabit those inner rooms and know the depths and heights of God and call outside to the rest of us how wonderful it is. Sometimes I take a deeper look in. Sometimes I venture in a little further, but my place seems closer to the door, so I stand by the door. There is another reason why I stand there. Some people get partway in and become afraid, lest God and the zeal of his house devour them, for God is so very great, and he asks all of us. And these people feel a cosmic claustrophobia, and they want to get out. Let me out, they cry, and the people way inside only terrify them more. Somebody must be by the door to tell them that they are spoiled. See, for once you have seen and touched, tasted God, then nothing but God will do anymore. Somebody must be watching for the frightened who seek to sneak out just when they came in to tell them how much better it is inside. The people too far in do not see how near these are to leaving, preoccupied with the wonder of it all. Somebody must watch for those who have entered the door but would like to run away. So for them too, I stand by the door. I admire the people that go way in, but I wish they would not forget how it was before they got in. Then they would be able to help the people who have not yet even found the door, or the people who want to run away from God. You can go in too deeply and stay too long and forget the people outside the door. As for me, I shall take my old accustomed place near enough to God to hear him and know that he is there, but not so far from people as not to hear them and remember that they are there too. Where? Outside the door. Thousands of them, millions of them. But more important for me, one of them, two of them, perhaps 10 of them, whose hands I am intended to put on the latch. So I shall stand by the door and wait for those who seek it. I had rather be a doorkeeper, so I stand by the door. I have a tremendous debt to the men and women who are outside of themselves enough to watch for guys like me, who came into the hospitals and institutions hoping just to catch one guy like me. I thank you for my life. Want to say anything before we close?
Thank you, Bob. I just want to say thank you so much for allowing me to be here with you this weekend. It has absolutely been a pleasure and an enlightenment, and I just thank you for allowing me the privilege. Thanks.
Indulge me in something we did last year. Let's whisper the Lord's Prayer and end with the word amen. Nothing after the word amen. Hook up. Can't turn the power on until we complete the circuit. Circle practice at 2 o'clock. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power,